The following is a lecture delivered by Edward Goldsmith, Teddy Goldsmith, in 1995. It was organized by the Scientific and Medical Network in Scotland, and it provides an introduction to the philosophy presented in his book, The Way, An Ecological Worldview. It starts with a quote. "The whole of our experience is nothing more than a massive divergence from that path which we should have taken if we had wanted to maintain the critical order of the cosmos, on which we depend for our survival, and in fact, we have no other alternative but to return." I have been involved in publishing, editing, and co-editing The Ecologist for the last 25 years. My main preoccupation has been the destruction of the natural world, the world in which we live. Looking at our planet, I adopt a fairly pessimistic view, just like Jean Harding, who talked to us earlier on. I see things very much like she does. What are the changes that are required if we are going to survive on this planet in perpetuity? It is clear to me that these changes are of a very radical nature. I think we have to change the whole structure of our society. It is quite clear to me that since the world is now being destroyed so quickly, then it is largely because our economic activities are no longer under any control at all. Corporations. The corporations that now dominate this world do exactly what they like. They are becoming more and more powerful, with the vast technology and finance now at their disposal, and this huge market we are creating for their goods. If the Uruguay round of the GATT Treaty is ratified, which of course it was, and allowed to materialize, then we are actually delivering the world on a platter to the very large corporations to do whatever they like. There will no longer be any constraints whatsoever on their economic activities. The constraints will become automatically GATT illegal. For instance, 90% of American environmental legislation would almost certainly be made GATT illegal. So I was told recently by my friends in the media in Washington. So it is clear to me that man cannot coexist with multinational and transnational corporations. I find it difficult to avoid facing that conclusion. The state, its institutions, and the legal system. It is the structure of our society which is the problem, and the state is particularly destructive. The modern state is a development agency, just as much as a corporation is. They are both propped up by our prime ministers, who are little more than managing directors. They buzz around the world trying to create markets for products and services which they want to sell. They are not concerned with any of the real issues, any of our own social, ecological, or biological issues. They are only concerned with economics. Even the law is not immune. It is an astonishing thought that we can completely destroy this planet, make it uninhabitable, and assure the extinction of our species without violating a single law. Audience laughed at that point. Is it a horrifying thought? It is a horrifying thought, is it not? I love it. It's an astonishing thought that we can completely destroy this planet and make it uninhabitable and assure the extinction of our species without violating a single law. We obviously need a totally new law designed to protect the world we live in, and hence ourselves, rather than just protect private property, which is basically what the present law is doing. I'll say it again. We need a totally new law designed to protect the world we live in, and hence ourselves, rather than just to protect private property, which is basically what the present law is doing. For instance, when Camel Ford had a terrible accident, the water supply became badly polluted. The health of a lot of people was affected. But they discovered that there was nothing they could do. The law was not on their side. If you demonstrated that you had been very badly damaged physically, it made no difference. You could not sue on those grounds. But you could only sue if one of your cows had been killed, or even simply just damaged, because cows are classified as property. But the health of human individuals are not. So the law will protect the cow, the property, but it will not protect you. We need fundamental changes to our institutions, the corporations, the state itself, the legal system, and everything else. Fundamental changes. In my opinion, the only type of social and economic structure that works is a traditional one, the one in which we have always lived for 99% of our tenancy on this planet. That is, in families. And by families, I mean extended families and communities. You might say it is difficult to recreate them, and I agree. It is very difficult to recreate them. In fact, to solve any of our problems is extremely difficult, but to go on in the present direction is impossible. That is the difference. What our leaders want to do is impossible. At the current rate, we will be extinct within 50 years. What we want to do is only difficult. Traditional societies and their worldviews. To me, there is no alternative to returning to the family and the community, which are the units of all sorts of activities, including economic activities, which is what they have always been in the past. But it is not just the structure which is critical, as I discuss in my book, The Way. It is not only because of the way we are organized today that we are heading towards disaster. It is also because of the worldview with which we are embedded. It is a worldview which I see as being totally ineffective in terms of what we might call the paradigm of science, or what I think Fritjof Capra calls the picture of the world that science paints. This picture of the world that science paints, this whole paradigm of science, today reflects the worldview with which we are imbued. What is this worldview? It is quite clear that there is a close relationship between the structure of our society and its worldview. To me, a worldview basically serves to rationalize and hence legitimize a particular way. Again, a worldview basically serves to rationalize and hence legitimize a particular way. I think it is quite easy to see that when looking at the behavior of a tribal society, you can see that their mythology serves above all to legitimize their behavior. The mythologies tell us exactly what their original ancestors believed, the laws that they enacted. It all tells a story. The story of their lives. If you read the story of their lives, you can almost see what they believed. There's a writer called Gerardo Richel Dalmatov, who is a very famous Colombian anthropologist, who sees the mythology of a tribal society as the model. For him, instead of there being normal variables to the model, as in a quantitative mathematical model, instead, the variables relate to the spirits, and there are clear relationships between them. This is so true that you can stimulate events in the real world that affect a particular spirit in a particular way, and this will affect the other spirits in a different way. You know precisely what behavior is required to reestablish the correct balance between these spirits. This is certainly the way that Richel Dalmatov sees it. Mythology is of enormous importance. Editor's note, or audio editor's note, he wrote this before or right around when Stuart Guthrie wrote his now famous book, Faces in the Clouds. Oxford University Press, 1992 is when I think it came out, maybe 94, which is now the foundation for an entire field, an entire discipline of evolutionary religious studies, namely that our brains are inherently relational, and the way all traditional societies have done that is to unconsciously relate to reality in a personal way, in an I-thou way. So it's not so much that they believed in spirits or gods, they just related personally to the various dimensions and aspects of inescapable reality. And I would argue that we have no examples of sustainable cultures that didn't do that. The paradigm of science and the worldview of modernism. In a sense, I see much of our science as being mythology which serves to rationalize all sorts of behavior patterns. I once wrote a long article in The Ecologist attacking the philosophy of Ilya Prigogine, who was a Nobel laureate in chemistry and a cult figure in the intellectual world of Belgium and France. He is a god, like Hitler. He wanders around with all sorts of geneticists, anthropologists, and biologists. He's sort of a pop singer who wanders around with his trombonists and everything else. He's a cult figure. But I think he's fundamentally wrong, and I tried to show that his whole thesis is little more than a scientific mythology serving to rationalize what he is really alluding to, which is genetic engineering. That is his principal preoccupation. And to justify his genetic engineering and other superstyle technologies, he has invented this massive scientific mythology, which in my opinion has no basis in the real world of reality whatsoever. For me, the most fundamental feature of this worldview, the most fundamental tenet, if you like, is that all beliefs and hence all wealth is man-made. Nothing, none of this wealth is derived from the normal functioning of the biosphere. Everything is man-made. Health is something that is acquired in hospitals by doctors and in chemists by buying pills. Law and order, if there are crime waves in Los Angeles, you solve that by hiring more policemen, buying more burglar alarms, and spending more money on prisons. It is man-made, you see. Even society is man-made. It is a product of the social contract. Primitive, normal society was totally chaotic for the people of luxury. The citizens we cannot take care of anymore must sign the contract and agree to delegate power to some authority who will run with their voice. That is the social contract. Even social order is man-made. Before social order, in the words of Hobbes, man's life was, quote, nasty, brutish, and short. Life. Nasty, brutish, and short. Astonishing. Solitary. Poor. Nasty, brutish, and short. Audience laughter. Now, if you really believe that all benefits are man-made, then clearly economic development is inevitable, because economic development is the only means of assuring the proliferation of man-made institutions and technological devices. Hence, it must be the only means of maximizing benefits and health, and hence our wealth. They fit in perfectly. These things follow perfectly from one another. These are, to me, the most fundamental principles. I'll say that again. Now, if you really believe that all benefits are man-made, and then clearly economic development is inevitable, because economic development is the only means of assuring the proliferation of man-made institutions and technological devices. Hence, it must be the only means of maximizing benefits and health, and hence our wealth. Diverging from the way. There is a path, or way, which is the term I've used in the title of my book, which enables us to maximize benefits in health and wealth. Today, however, this path is economic development, which we are taught to identify with progress. Any problems, such as the ones occurring in Los Angeles today, are attributed to our failure to diverge sufficiently from this way, from progress. We have apparently not progressed enough. People are starving in the third world, we are told, and the reason is because they have not invested sufficiently in fertilizers, pesticides, irrigation water, hybrid seeds, and everything else. The problem of this lack of investment can apparently be solved only by more economic progress to give them the wealth to buy all these things. If they are poor, then again, it is because there has not been enough economic growth. Now, you will find these claims in the statements of all our main institutions, in particular the World Bank and the Food and Agricultural Organization. This, to me, is their main thesis. Mechanomorphism. Now, there are many other aspects to this worldview of modernism, some of which were described by Rupert Sheldrake. It is a mechanistic or mechanomorphic worldview, one where all living things are regarded as machines. The world is seen to be a machine, which of course made sense in the days of Descartes, because you could not have a world as a machine if there was no God to create the machine. But since then, we have abolished God, so we're now faced with the most absurd dogma, because we are now faced with a machine that has come into being by itself, without a God who made it. This idea is defined by Woodger. I do not know if you're familiar with the biological principles, but he goes into this in some depth in a book that is no longer widely read. He points out that we now exist faced with a machine without a maker and without a heart. Oh, I like that. We now exist faced with a machine without a maker and without a heart. It is self-created or self-functioning machine. That is the world we live in, which is most astonishing. If we talk about superstition, this must be the most absurd of all superstitions in existence. Yet it is fundamental to the notion of the mechanistic world and of mechanomorphism, which underlies the modern worldview. Okay, so I need to look up Woodger, Woodger's book, The Biological Principles. Sacred ecology. Well, of course, there are other aspects to this worldview. It is a world where the world is de-sanctified. The notion of sanctity, as Rupert Sheldrake talked about, is a very important notion, too. It is not at all certain that we can survive in a world which has lost the notion of the sacred. The notion of the sacred, it seems to me, is fundamental for any sort of sustainable society. I do not see that it is possible to survive without it. And I'm going to say this again. when the world is desanctified, that is, it's no longer seen as sacred, he says, it's not at all certain that we can survive in a world which has lost the notion of the sacred. The notion of the sacred seems to me fundamental for any sort of sustainable society. It's not possible to survive without it. What is, in fact, the sacred? Well, it is a very difficult question to answer, but there are some answers I like better than others. Marcellus Eliade's answer is, to me, very important. Both he and Titus Burckhardt of the Perennial Philosophy School provide a similar definition of the sacred. Fundamental to the ecological worldview, which I will come to in a minute, is the notion that the biosphere is one, and that it is organized in a hierarchical fashion. The cosmos. We also regard the cosmos as more than just the biosphere, and this cosmos has a definite structure, which tribal man, the original man, saw himself as part of. He believed very much in what became to be regarded as the microcosm-macrocosm worldview. He saw, for instance, the structure of his body as being reflected in the body of his family and of his community and of the cosmos itself, as well as all his artifacts. For instance, the house of traditional man was designed so as to reflect the order of the cosmos. It was designed according to the same principles. It was absolutely critical that it should also be designed in this way, just as the society was designed so as to reflect the order of the cosmos. This concept is examined in great detail by Ananda Kumaraswamy, who is one of the great members of the Perennial Philosophy Group. Now, for Kumaraswamy and Eliade, something is sacred to the extent that it has been cosmicized or brought into the structure of the cosmos. So, for instance, if you start a new settlement or make a new village, it has to be sanctified. To sanctify it meant bringing it within the structure of the cosmos so that you could relate to it in peace. This whole notion of cosmicization, or maybe only part of that notion, was so that you could relate to it, so that it had meaning to you for everything you did, because everything was related to the cosmos as a whole. Everything you did had an effect on the cosmos. The structure of your house, the structure of your tribe and your family reflected the structure of the cosmos, which gave meaning to everything that you did, whereas the things that we do today have no meaning at all. So this notion of the sacred seems essential to me, and once something is sacred, you cannot destroy it. It is holy. You cannot change it. It is there. It is something which cannot be changed in any way because it has been created by the gods who created the cosmos. As soon as you desanctify something, then it is open to exploitation. And once the whole cosmos itself is desanctified, then it is something that can be changed until the heart is content. You can do it. You can do what you like to it. Wipe it out. So this notion of the cosmos as sacred, to me, is a critical thing. Clathonic religion. That's C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C. Clathonic religion. But without going into all of this, let us look at the opposite worldview, what I take to be the worldview of ecology. First of all, for me, the worldview of ecology is necessarily the worldview of Clathonic man. Now let us consider this Clathonic religion. Clathon was the god of the earth. The Clathonic religion was really the religion of the earth. And you can find that people living in their families and communities, before they were organized into larger groups like nations, had a fundamentally Clathonic religion. The religion of the ancient Greeks, for instance, is very well described. Now, this Clathonic religion has a very different worldview to the worldview of the modern world. In fact, it is the total opposite. To begin with, the basic tenet of this Clathonic religion, which I take to be also the basic tenet of an ecological worldview, is that all benefits, instead of being derived from the man-made world, the technosphere, are derived instead from the biosphere, or the world of living things. I'll say that again. The basic tenet of Clathonic religion, which he also takes to be the basic tenet of the ecological worldview, is that all benefits, instead of being derived from the man-made world, the technosphere, are derived instead from the biosphere, or the world of living things. That's exactly the opposite of today. The normal functioning of the biosphere. Now, this is extremely important if you think about it. What are the most important benefits we have? Clearly, it must be a favorable and stable climate, which is something we benefit from and which is available on no other planet in our solar system, and although it is by no means certain, exists nowhere else. This must be the most important form of wealth that we have at our disposal. Obviously, fertile soil, abundant and clean water, all the wildlife, etc. All these things must be and are our natural wealth as well. And it is important to note that the biosphere itself, by and through its normal functioning, solves most of the problems which we face today. For instance, we may make pesticides, but probably 99% of all pests and potential pests are still controlled by the normal functioning of the biosphere, by all the different predators and parasites to which they are subjected. We may make fertilizers in our factories, but it is probable that 99%, if not more, of all the fertility that is now required to grow our crops and to keep our forests going is also provided by the normal functioning of the biosphere. If you were to kill off nitrogen-fixing bacteria, you would not be able to build all the fertilizer factories that we would require to make up for it, insofar as artificial fertilizer could make up for it. So in fact, we are totally dependent upon the normal functioning of the biosphere. Yet we are destroying this biosphere rapidly to fulfill our basic goal of expanding, instead, the technosphere, and to minimize the availability of technospheric so-called benefits. Conflicting worldviews. Now, one can best illustrate this difference between the two worldviews with reference to the Chitko movement of the Himalayas. This is a movement which has been started by villagers who are trying to preserve their forests because they know that their welfare depends entirely on the normal functioning of the forests. What happens is that when the loggers, usually government loggers, appear, the women stream out of their villages and they go and hug the trees, and they tell the loggers that if they want to cut down the trees, they must kill them first. This movement has spread throughout the Himalayas and affects quite a substantial area. In fact, the leader of this movement is coming to London on the 5th of May in 1995. Sundargalal Baguna is a remarkable man. They have developed their own culture, their own songs, and their own dances. It's quite astonishing how this has spread. The songs are particularly beautiful. In one of the songs, they recall a meeting between the village woman and the forest officials, and they ask the question, "What are the forests for?" And the forest officials answer, "The forests are for timber, resin, and foreign exchange." And then the women reply by asking the same question, "What are the forests for?" And their answer is, "For soil, water, and pure air. Soil, water, and pure air are the basis of our life." So here you have a fundamental confrontation between two totally different and conflicting worldviews. One you might call the worldview of modernism, with which we are totally preoccupied because of the material and economic benefits to be derived from the forest. And the other worldview, which is the worldview of the village people, who see the forests only as a source of soil, water, and pure air. They are not the least bit interested in the resin and the foreign exchange. It plays no part in their lives. So this is a confrontation between the two worldviews. The integrity of the biosphere. The second most important tenet of the ecological worldview, and hence the Chthonic worldview, must be that these benefits are only provided by the biosphere so long as we respect its integrity. Okay, these benefits can only be provided by the biosphere so long as we respect its integrity. Now, this is very clear. If you cut the forest down, clearly they will no longer be able to provide you with the benefits. You won't get the soil, the water, and the pure air. Let us consider today, what are the problems that we face? The problems that we face today are caused by the disruption of natural systems at all levels, the many diseases that we suffer from, or the degenerative diseases that are epidemic and escalating throughout the industrial world, whatever the problems may be. Social problems are caused by the breakdown of the family and the community. So hence, we get all these terrible problems like delinquency, crime, and drug addiction, which are little more than symptoms of social deprivation and family and community breakdown. Similarly, these floods, which we now get throughout the world and which are increasing are getting worse and worse, the epidemics, the droughts, climate change, all these problems are caused by the destruction of natural systems. Science and technology. What is important is that against these problems, modern technology can do nothing. Technology is very good at solving technological problems, like going to the moon. It is a very impressive feat to go to the moon, but it doesn't solve any basic human problems. Man has suffered from a lot of things, but he has never suffered from not going to the moon. There is no technological solution to these problems. Surprisingly enough, our scientists still think that there are technological solutions. If you had read the U.S. National Academy of Sciences' recent report on climate change, which is the most disgraceful thing that you could ever see, they do not actually say that we have to do anything. They suggest the possibility of geoengineering. Geoengineering? They say we can combat climate change by putting out in space 50,100 square kilometer mirrors, which will reflect the heat of the sun away from the Earth. They also say that we can equip airplanes with new engines that do not burn up the fuel properly, so that they emit a vast amount of soot as they fly, which will protect us, quote-unquote, from the sun's radiation. Now imagine living on a planet whose climate is entirely regulated by these sorts of absurd technological devices. You could not imagine anything more absurd. You can imagine the so-called sustainability of a society of this sort. How do we know we can maintain these things? Will we have the money to keep 100,000 or 50,000 100 kilometer mirrors in space indefinitely? The whole thing is farcical. I mean, you have got to be a child to believe this is possible, and we're being offered more and more of these so-called geoengineering solutions. There's a man called Professor Adler who actually suggested that the world's climate was due to the moon, and that the moon had a very bad influence on climate, and that the answer was to nuke the moon. He said that perhaps certain people with poetic inclinations or with romantic inclinations might not like this. But they shouldn't worry, because with the development of modern science, it was just a matter of time before we'd be able to pluck another moon from some remote galaxy and relocate it in the sky, but at a more convenient distance. Of course, the audience is laughing as he's saying this. You know, so it doesn't interfere with the climate, and still fulfills its romantic and poetic functions. This man has been taken seriously, of course. The Czech Academy of Sciences apparently wrote to him to ask for more details. Laughter. So you see, we think that technical, scientific solutions are possible. There are no technical solutions to any of these problems. For instance, science and technology are hopeless at dealing with degenerative diseases. There's very little you can do against diabetes and all these many forms of cancer, ischemic heart disease, diverticulitis, I can't pronounce it. Their incidence continues simply to grow, and we are just incapable of dealing with them. The way of archaic societies. Why do I mention all of this? Well, the answer to all of this is the way. Clearly, the most basic, fundamental, and essential thing that we can do is maintain and preserve the integrity of the biosphere in the cosmos, as Chthonic man fully realized. We must realize, too, that eventually there must be a particular behavior pattern that we must design, whose goal is to achieve this end. That is to say, there must be a path, and we must work out the path which we are to follow if we are to maintain the critical order of the biosphere. I'm going to read this again. So why do I mention all this? Well, the answer is to all of this is the way. Clearly, the most basic, fundamental, and essential thing that we need to do is to maintain and preserve the integrity of the biosphere and the cosmos, as Chthonic man fully realized. We must realize, too, that eventually there must be a particular behavior pattern that we must design, whose goal is to achieve this end. That is to say, there must be a path, and we must work out the path which we are to follow if we want to maintain the critical order of the biosphere. Looking through the literature concerning the lives of traditional peoples, it seems clear that traditional man always did this. There is such a path, and it is easy to see that the basic behavior pattern of traditional man was designed to do just this. Now, this is what I have tried to show in this book, The Way. In many of these archaic societies, to use this term, there was a word for this path or way. The most obvious one, which everybody knows about, is the Tao. You know, the Taoists. But it was actually something that was interceded. That means something that was anticipated, that was developed long before Lao Tzu, who later adopted it. This Tao or way is nothing but that. It is and means the path. It means the way. It means the way of nature, capital N. It means the path that maintains the order of the cosmos. It means that. In the ancient Indian literature, you will find it in the Vedas. In the Vedas, there is the term Ratha. The Ratha was precisely that, the path that maintains the order of the cosmos, i.e. the path you must follow to maintain the order of the cosmos. It was the natural path. It is behaving naturally, and if you took a contrary path, it was known as the Anrata, and you can see that in the other literature as well. Eventually, it was personalized. You will find that again and again in these archaic societies, a god or goddess who represents the Rata. Bahuna in India. It was Themis in Greece. The Greeks called the path the Dike, D-I-K-E. It was also called Themis, and I will come back to that in a moment. Particularly important, in ancient Egypt, it was called the Mahata, M-A-A-T. In the Avestas of Persia, it was called Asher. Later in India, it became the Dharma. The term Rata ceased to be used, though the term Anrata subsisted, and the term Dharma replaced it, and the Dharma was taken up by the Buddhists. The term Dharma is still used in Buddhist religion, very explicitly indeed. It is very important to their worldview. So what is particularly important about these terms is that it is by following this path that you observe the traditional law of your society, enacted by the heroes and the gods in the mythical period where all laws were enacted. In Ilio Temporor, to use a term by Mircea Eliade, meaning in the dawn period, a term also used by Natalie Brown. Now, this law and these laws are very interesting in terms of today's total disidentification between the laws that govern societies and the laws that govern the natural world and those that govern the cosmos. Pythagoras said it himself with his nomos and the cities of man. Nomos was the law that governed society, and dike, D-I-K-E, in the natural world. I forget the terms he used, and themis in the world of the gods. They are exactly the same, exactly the same. If you think about it, it has to be so. Now, as I said earlier, our legal system is currently such that you can destroy the planet without violating any laws. You can destroy your society without violating these laws. In the case of chthonic man, traditional man, this is not so. On the contrary, the laws that governed society were exactly the same as those which governed nature, which it has to be. To try to develop a new law, which I think we have to do, you have to remember that seeking new paths is the goal. It is quite evident that we have one single law governing the whole of Gaian hierarchy, from man and his society all the way up. Vital force. Well, now, what is important to me is that this same notion exists not only in these archaic societies that invented terms for the way, but also in societies that had not yet developed a term for the way. Now you can find that one of the things that seems to be common to all known tribal societies, I don't know of any exceptions to this, is the notion of a vital force, known by the Polynesians and the Melanesians as mana. And there's a word for it in just about every traditional society that you can name. Now, this notion of vital force is very critical because your success in life is seen in our traditional society, as depending entirely on your stock of vital force. For instance, if you are interested in agriculture, you have got to behave in such a way that you are not worrisome about maximizing yields and not so worried about availability of fertilizer. Instead, you were worried about following the traditional laws in such a way as to maximize your stock of vital force. It is not just a question of maximizing your own stock of vital force. Rather, it is a way of maximizing the vital force within your society and indeed within the biosphere itself, because each society sees vital force as being distributed within society and in the biosphere in accordance with a particular pattern. And the literature on the subject is very interesting because it shows that the way in which vital force is distributed depends on the structure of society. Tribal societies. In a society which is highly decentralized, like the Igbos of Nigeria, who live in villages and have no hierarchical structure, they see vital force as being present largely at each level of the village. They do not think of it at any high level. Each person has a vital force for the village community itself. In contrast, for the people in a society which is highly centralized, like, for example, Japan, most of the vital force will reside in the person, the emperor, who influences society at the top, and there will be far less in the subsidiary people. Nobles would have their stock, but most of it would reside in the person who is the divine king. This is gone into in great length by James Frazer in The Golden Bough. As you may remember, in The Golden Bough, there was this whole phenomenon about killing the king, like in the Sikh religion. In many societies, you killed the king after a certain number of years. In other words, you killed him when he shows signs of aging. If his hair falls out, you would have to kill the poor bastard. In other words, he could no longer satisfy his wives, which is a horrific thought. He is immediately wiped out, you see, Goldsmith laughs. Now, in some societies, they actually kill the king every year, and Frazer shows in enormous detail how they used to kill the king for many reasons, to create a continuum of character, for instance. The king was killed every year. Eventually, it was frightfully difficult to find a man who was willing to be king. Audience laughs. So what they did to solve this was by commissioning a slave that would be the king for one day. And for the length of the day, he would enjoy all the prerogatives of king and live in unbelievable splendor with a massive number of elephants and all things at the king's disposal. He would live like the king for a day. And by the end of the evening, they would just wipe him out, you see. And then the audience laughs. Now, why? Why do you explain this astonishing phenomenon, which you find everywhere where you have a divine king? The answer is because the king was the repository of this vital force. And if he was no longer fit for the repository of this vital force, the people would run into the most unbelievable things. There would be nothing to protect them against epidemics, enemy attacks, floods, droughts, all the horrors of the world. So somehow or other, they had to find a fitting repository for the king. For the vital force. Now, this is the significance of vital force. You can see that if this vital force is organized within a society in such a way as to reflect its basic structure, and within the biosphere as well, so as to reflect its basic structure, the behavior pattern of the members of society must be that maintains this correct distribution of vital force, which means the correct traditional structure of that society and of the biosphere. It is exactly the same thing. It is really by doing that you maximize all benefits, and it's by failing to do that you run into all kinds of problems and things start going wrong. Animism. Well, it is very similar with the religion of tribal man, because the religion of tribal man is animism. They had their holy mountains and their holy rivers. Even today, the tribal society in New Zealand, located as far as you can get from Auckland, New Zealand's capital, have a mountain, a huge river, a mountain, and a river. They are associated with the holy river and the holy mountain. As you know, there were holy mountains among the Jews. Pre-Mosaic Jews were tribal people who had their holy mountains. As soon as they created a national religion, they were deprived of their holy mountains. They were told that only one mountain was holy, and the others were no longer holy. The ecological gods, the clathonic gods, were killed. They had to be uprooted and removed to make way for the national god, who was Yahweh, a process which is well described in that quite remarkable book called Essays on the Religion of the Semites by Robertson Smith. He was not referring to the Jews. He was writing about the Arabs in northern Arabia. You show in this animistic religion that everything is alive. The whole notion of the world being alive is critical to the animistic view. Absolutely critical. Tribal peoples were alive because they had their spirits, whether they are stones or whatever they are. Everything is part of the cosmic hierarchy and represented by spirits. The spirits are graduated according to their needs, and I am sure the amount of vital force they have is a measure of their importance to the functioning of the cosmos. The cosmos for tribal man was really the world of the gods. Now the gods are organized hierarchically, as I've said. The most obvious and most important gods that people worshipped were important in the sense that everybody worshipped them, were the gods of the heart. Audio editor's note here. Teddy Goldsmith couldn't have possibly been aware of the scholarship that's come out in the last 20 years or so, summarized best in Stuart Guthrie's Oxford University Press book, Faces in the Clouds, A New Theory of Religion, which is that, I think I mentioned this earlier, these gods are about personal relationship to the various aspects of reality. They're not spirits or disembodied entities. The gods. The Penates were the gods of the family in Rome. Almost all religions have this ancestor worship at the level of the family. Though the word worship is probably wrong, Jomo Kenyatta was one of the first Africans to write an account of the worldview and behavior of his own tribe, the Kikuyus. The Kikuyus and other Africans do not, in fact, worship their gods. They talk with them. They have certain obligations toward their gods, and if they fulfill these obligations, they expect the gods to fulfill theirs toward the people. He describes their ancestor worship, quote-unquote, but he does not like the term. He prefers to call it a communion with the ancestors, because they do not actually worship them. They have certain obligations toward them, and you have certain obligations toward them. And if you fulfill your obligations, you fulfill them to fulfill theirs. You expect them to fulfill theirs. And if you talk with them, you say, "You're a son of a bitch. I fulfilled my obligations. Why haven't you fulfilled yours?" is more of a sort of relationship than the one of just kneeling there, you see. It's a communion with the ancestors, as he refers to it. Now, this whole notion is critical. And the gods of the family are tremendously important to people's lives. And so are the gods of the clan, of the community, etc. If you live in these highly centralized cities, it is the gods of the emperor himself. It is the ancestors you are talking about. The gods of the family are the ancestors, the spirits. Social cybernetics. Now, they are organized in such a way as to reflect the social structure of their society. And if you look at the literature on the subject, you will see that this is just the case. In Japan, there is a tremendous hierarchy of the gods, with the ancestors on top being tremendously important. The people of Alor are not a highly centralized people. They are, on the contrary, individualized with very little hierarchy. The gods are seen as organized in exactly the same manner, individualized. There's an excellent book on this subject about the highly individualized society on the islands of Indonesia, where the gods are also seen as being highly individualistic. So you can see that within all these societies, your organization of your gods reflect the structure of your society and of the biosphere itself, because you have the gods of nature. Now, it seems to me tremendously important, because in such societies, to serve your gods is to maintain the structure of the pantheon. And to maintain the structure of the pantheon means maintaining the structure of your society and of the biosphere on which they are a part. And of course, all this makes sense. Editor's note, of course, all this makes sense when you understand personification. The stable society. Now, when you move away from this religion, it tends to be when society breaks down. When there's no longer a community, you no longer have communal gods, because there's no longer a community for the gods to represent. When you break down the society itself, there are no longer the social gods. And when you atomize a society, what happens? You are left with a single word, God. Monotheism is something which is associated with the breakdown of society. That is how I see it. It is a breakdown. Nevertheless, you can see here that whether a society actually entertains the notion of the way explicitly, whether it believes entirely in this notion of vital force, according to Eliade and various others, this notion of vital force predates the notion of personalized gods. The belief in these cosmic forces came first. They were personalized much later. So if you believe in all of that, then of course you have to accept this whole notion of trying to maintain the order of the cosmos as a prerequisite to obtain its inestimable benefits. Now, this brings us to the final consideration. If you accept this ecological worldview, then necessarily you must interpret all of our problems as being no more than divergences from the way. In other words, there is this pattern of behavior which is sanctified and requires you to maintain the order of the cosmos, and which thereby maximizes benefits. If, suddenly, there are terrible problems, you know that it is caused by the fact that you have diverted from the way, which upsets the order of the cosmos. It can be the only possible explanation, and you have probably caused it. This is a perfectly sound interpretation, and it's absolutely correct. If we have got floods in India, it's because we've cut the forests down. If the climate is changing, it's because we're upsetting the normal conditions of the atmosphere. We're changing the chemical composition of the atmosphere, which is catastrophe. So this is inevitable. It means that you are not correcting a divergence from the path. This is perfectly normal cybernetic behavior, and it goes right back to the Cherod, C-H-R-E-O-D, of C.H. Waddington. Epigenesis. The embryo in the womb has got to move in a particular direction in order to achieve its end state. The path it takes is called by Waddington the epigenetic landscape, which is really a constellation of individual chairods, or paths. These chairods come from the Greek word for the necessary path, and is a constellation of paths, and a constellation of paths is called an epigenetic landscape. In other words, the embryo develops along its epigenetic landscape and is capable of correcting divergences from the epigenetic landscape, returning to its path. Hans Dreyer, the famous German biologist or geneticist, formulated his particular form of vitalism, which we all know as entelechy, from Aristotle's Entelechia. He looked at this phenomenon saying, quote, "I cannot explain this in mechanistic terms. How can I possibly explain that there is an embryo and I can change it, mutilate it, do all sorts of things to it, divert it from its course, and it'll go back to its original course? How can I explain that in mechanistic terms?" So he postulated this particular form of vitalism, which we call entelechy. Well, to me, it is quite evident that the development of an embryo in the womb is not something that occurs by itself. It is not just one process. The process continues, and it is the same process during the time that a child grows up within its family, because that child does not grow up by itself. It grows up as part of a family, which is part of a community. The fact that this community behaves in the same way, maintaining itself along the way, and correcting divergences from it, may be so. It makes perfect sense. First, it is doing exactly the same thing as in nature. It is just observing what must be the basic law of the biosphere, of the way the biosphere functions. Well, this brings us back again to what I'm actually stating, which is that we have diverted from the way of our ancestors. And this sounds very romantic, very out of touch with reality, but I think it's inevitably the case for our whole experience of the last 150 years and probably for much longer. Returning to the way. The whole of our recent experience is nothing more than a massive divergence from that path which we should have taken if we had wanted to maintain the critical order of the cosmos, on which we depend for our survival, and in fact, which we have no alternative but to return. And that means, in fact, reversing what we call economic development, or so-called progress, which is taking us further and further from it. It means, in fact, that we have no alternative but changing the structure of our society and reducing the scale on which our economic activities are conducted, bringing economic activities back under control. And I do not think that they can be brought back under control until they are carried out at a much smaller level by families and communities, who are not just economic units. They are also units of ceremonial activities for religion, for bringing up children, for looking after the old. They do all sorts of things. Economic activity is just one of the things that they do. And under these conditions, economic activities can easily be put under control or embedded once more in social relations, as the economic historian Karl Polanyi pointed out that they originally were. Once they are in the hands of corporations, who become more and more powerful, economic activities become disembedded from social relations, out of control. And we get the sort of situation we're in today. So we have no alternative but to return to the sort of social structures that we existed in during the greater part of the tendency of our experience on this planet. We have no alternative but to govern ourselves as we previously did. The state does not work. Traditional man governed himself perfectly well because he knew how to do it. It was done by citizens who are themselves part of their communities, whereas we are now governed by a body which is totally external to the community that is called upon to govern, We have no alternative but to return to governance at the level of the community, nor do we have any alternative but to adopt a worldview, an ecological worldview, which has a great deal in common with the worldview of our traditional chthonic ancestors, one that leads us to follow the way, that maintains the order of the cosmos, rather than do exactly the opposite, which can only lead to total disaster.